Tonight, brothers and sisters, we have a slight change of programme, that we're still to consider Psalms 90 and 91, but our speaker will be Brother Nathan Toms instead of Brother Alan Wharton as on the programme. Now, we're going to read both of the Psalms, but we'll start by reading Psalm 90 and then continue with Psalm 91 partway through the address. So now we're pleased to invite Brother Nathan to speak to us on Psalms 90 and 91.
Well, good evening, dear brothers and sisters. When we come to Psalms, these two Psalms, we actually are starting the fourth book of the Psalms, which runs from Psalm 90 to Psalm 106. And if you look at the heading of the first of those Psalms, Psalm 90, you'll see that it is ascribed to Moses. The author is attributed to Moses. It's described as a prayer of Moses, the man of God. Second Psalm, 91, is anonymous, like most of the Psalms in this part of the in this book four. Some commentators also attribute Psalm 91 to Moses, but it seems to be a bit lacking in evidence for this. The main evidence seems to be that it simply comes next to Psalm 90. The Septuagint ascribes Psalm 91 to David, although again the evidence for this doesn't seem to be particularly strong. So I think it's fair to say, at the least, that we can't be sure that these two psalms have a common human author. But I think, as we'll see as we go through this evening, there do seem to be very good reasons to consider them as a pair. They are complementary in many ways, and in many ways they present opposite views of the human experience of God. This psalm of Moses, Psalm 90, is largely negative, whereas Psalm 91 is almost exclusively positive. And again, we'll look at the reasons for this towards the end of the evening. So what I'd like to do this evening is to start by looking at each psalm individually, and we'll finish with a sort of side-by-side comparison of the two, and I'll ask Brother John to read Psalm 91 a bit later on when we come to that section. So let's begin with looking at Psalm 90 in a little bit more detail. It's the only psalm that is attributed to Moses in the whole book of the Psalms. There's no other indication of when it was written, but it would seem to fit with something written towards the end of his life. And I think we can see that if we compare it with a couple of other examples we have of Moses' songwriting. And the first of these is found in Exodus, excuse me, Exodus 15, if we just turn back to that. And this is the song sung by Moses and the Israelites immediately after the destruction of the Egyptians at the Red Sea. Exodus 15, verse 1. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spake, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. And more specifically, verse 4. Pharaoh's chariots and his host hath he cast into the sea. His chosen captains also are drowned in the Red Sea. Now, if we glance down this song recorded in Exodus, we find, as we might expect given the context, that it is overwhelmingly triumphant in tone. It's a celebration of God's active care for his people, and it looks forward to God providing them a permanent resting place or habitation for them. For example, verse 13. Thou in thy mercy hast led forth the people which thou hast redeemed. Thou hast guided them in thy strength unto thy holy habitation. Verse 17 to 18. Thou shalt bring them in and plant them in the mountain of thine inheritance, in the place, O Lord, which thou hast made for thee to dwell in the sanctuary, O Lord, which thy hands have established. The Lord shall reign for ever and ever. And this theme of habitation or dwelling comes out in the Psalms, as we'll see in a minute. But this song in Exodus 15 is what we might expect from Moses at this stage in his life. We can see this song as an expression of relief at what he thought must have been the end of the trials of the Exodus. Israel had been released from their slavery after an extraordinary demonstration of God's power, culminating in the final destruction of the remaining Egyptian military danger that might have threatened the Israelites as they travelled towards the land of promise. And we can see here that Moses' outlook was entirely positive. He had no idea at this stage of the decades of further testing that faced him, ending with the bitter disappointment of his exclusion from the land of promise. In contrast, another song written by Moses at the end of his life has a very different feel, and this is found in Deuteronomy 32. And this, in many ways, is quite similar to our psalm this evening. Let's get the context from Deuteronomy 31, verse 14. The Lord said unto Moses, Behold, the days approach that thou must die. So we're right at the end of Moses' life. He's been told that he is in fact going to die shortly. And then verse 22, Moses therefore wrote this song the same day and taught it the children of Israel. And this song is recorded in Deuteronomy 32. And it begins, as does Psalm 90, with a doxology. Verse 3 and 4 of Deuteronomy 32. I will publish the name of the Lord. Ascribe ye greatness unto our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment. A God of truth and without iniquity, just and right is he. But then the righteousness of God is contrasted starkly with the behaviour and attitudes of the Israelites. Verse 5. They have corrupted themselves. They are a perverse and crooked generation. And this is followed by God's rejection and punishment of his people. Verse 19. When the Lord saw it, he abhorred them because of the provoking of his sons and of his daughters. And verse 22. For a fire is kindled in mine anger and shall burn unto the lowest hell, and shall consume the earth with her increase, and set on fire the foundation of the mountains. And this, if we go back now to Psalm 90, parallels very similar sentiments in this psalm. For example, Psalm 90, verses 7 to 8. For we are consumed by thine anger, and by thy wrath are we troubled. Thou hast set our iniquities before thee, our secret sins, in the light of thy countenance. However, as we've just read, as Psalm 90 finishes with a prayer of hope for the righteous, so the anger expressed towards God's people in Moses' song in Deuteronomy is then focused on those who reject him, with a promise of restoration for a faithful remnant. Verse 43 of Deuteronomy 32. Rejoice, O ye nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants, and will render vengeance to his adversaries, and will be merciful unto his land and to his people. So, with Psalm 90 being so similar in sentiment and structure to this song recorded in Deuteronomy, I think it's fair to say it's likely that this psalm was also written towards the end of Moses' life. And there are also internal features which seem to fit with this idea, as we'll see in a few minutes. So coming back to Psalm 90, as mentioned earlier, the psalm begins with a doxology. And in this, God is described as a habitation for his people, and his eternal nature is stressed. And I'm sure verse 2 is very familiar to those of us who had to learn Sunday school proofs as youngsters. Psalm 90, verses 1 to 2. Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hadst formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Now, one consequence of the everlasting nature of God is that he views time differently. His experience of time is different to that of human beings. And this is brought out in verse 4. For 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night. Now, the speaker's commentary on this verse points out that both these phrases refer to events that are recalled at any length of time, whether it's a single day or even 1,000 years, can be reviewed in an instant in memory once it is past. And similarly, a watch in the night is normally slept through. It's unusual that you'd be awake during the night. And so effectively it appears to take no time at all. And in contrast, or complementing these ideas, very similar images are used to express the transience of man's experience. Verse 5, we described they are as asleep. Verse 9 in the King James says we spend our years as a tale that is told. It's something that's recalled. I think, were you reading the New King James, John? Yeah, it says as a sigh is an alternative translation. Again, it's the idea of something very transient. But both these verses underline the fleeting nature of man in contrast to the everlasting nature of God. But coupled with this is a very strong sense of being under the wrath of God. This habitation referred to in verse 1 is not a comfortable place to be. Verse 7 again. For we are consumed by thine anger, and by thy wrath are we troubled. As we just read, thou hast set our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in the light of thy countenance, for all our days are passed away in thy wrath. There's a couple of interesting points in these verses. The Israelites of Moses' generation were quite literally consumed by God's anger. They died in the wilderness because they displeased God. And I think Moses' words to the Reubenites and Gadites in Numbers 32 are particularly informative here. this was after they requested the land of Gilead as their possession. And again, it's an event happening right at the end of Moses' life. And this is Moses' response to this request. Numbers 32, verse 13. The Lord's anger burned against Israel, and he made them wander in the desert for 40 years, until the whole generation of those who had done evil in his sight was gone. And here you are, a brood of sinners, standing in the place of your fathers and making the Lord even more angry with Israel. That's from the NIV. The days of these Israelites quite literally passed away in God's wrath. The second point concerns the reference to the light of God's countenance. And normally we'd expect this to be in a very positive aspect. And Moses had the most direct experience of this of any man. God's described as speaking to him face to face as a man speaks to his friend. And we know how Moses' face itself had reflected the glory of God when he was given the law. But this glorious scrutiny in this psalm is not now directed towards the good of the people, but rather to discovering their imperfections, their secret iniquities, secret sins. And this was something that the Israelites experienced on a number of occasions throughout their history. I'll just read, for example, one verse from the prophecy through Amos, 9 verse 4. And though they go into captivity before their enemies, thence will I command the sword, and it shall slay them, and I will set mine eyes upon them for evil and not for good. So again, the faithless generation was being scrutinized by God to find out their sins rather than their good points. Now, an immediate result of God's wrath was unusually short lifespans for many of the Israelites who died in the wilderness. If we take a look at those who survived the Exodus, those whose ages we're given anyway, we find they typically live to comfortably over 100 years old. Moses lived to 120, Aaron was 123, Joshua is 110. And yet, many of the younger Israelites, if they were 40 or around 40 at the time of the Exodus, would have died before they were 80 years old. And this may explain, or is one explanation, for the reference to the lifespan and possibly the shortened lifespan in verse 10. The days of our years are 80 years, and if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength labour and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. And the premature death of the younger Israelites would have been a very stark reminder that they were subjects of God's anger. But a reminder that should have taught them to seek wisdom, as expressed in verse 11. So the psalm then finishes with a plea for God to fulfill the promises for good to his people, as he had fulfilled the promise to punish them for their sins. Verse 13, return, O Lord, how long, and let it repent thee concerning thy servants. Verse 15, make us glad according to the days wherein thou hast afflicted us, and the years wherein we have seen evil. And again, a little detail in verse 16 makes it appear that it's the future generations that are to experience the benefits of God's goodness. Psalm 90, verse 16, let thy work appear unto thy servants, and thy glory unto their children. And notice here that Moses says their children, not our children. And this would fit with the servants referred to being the new generation that were to enter the promised land, rather than the old generation that was to die. In contrast, this new generation, the contrast to their unfaithful parents. And God's work referred to then would then be the equivalent of God's work during the Exodus, but this time during the entry into the land. And the glory may refer to the blessings of the promised land to be finally experienced by the generation after that. And the final verse of the psalm brings these ideas to a head with the plea that God would again remember the good works of his people rather than the evil. Psalm 90, verse 17. Let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish thou the work of our hands upon us. Yea, the work of our hands, establish thou it. So I'd like to now move on to Psalm 90, but I'll ask Brother John to read that to us before I do so. Thank you, Brother John. Now, I'm sure you noticed that this next psalm could hardly be more different in tone to the preceding psalm. It celebrates God's care of his people, so much so that in the Talmud it's referred to as a song of accidents, that is, a protective or a talismanic song to be used in times of danger, and I believe the Catholic Church views it in a similar way. And there's quite a nice suggestion of how this psalm was used, which would fit with this idea. If you look down the psalm, and you may have noticed it as Brother John was reading it, you'll notice that the voice changes. For example, verse 2 is in the first person. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him will I trust. Whereas the next section, verses 3 to 8, are in the second person. Surely he shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. And the suggestion has been made that this was designed as a pilgrim psalm to be sung by two voices or two groups of people, one taking the first person parts and the other the second. The psalm also divides quite well into two sections, with verse 9 acting as a refrain, linking back to the original thoughts in verse 1, the idea of the refuge coming through. Now, whether this is the case or not, we can imagine that this psalm would have been very comforting to have in mind during, for example, a long and perilous journey. It fits very well with the idea of asking God to protect us in times of uncertainty. And the psalm finishes with an oracle, or a divine response, in verses 14 to 16, which is like divine confirmation of the care extended towards the psalmists by their God. Now, although it's very different in tone from Psalm 90, Psalm 91 begins with a very similar idea, that of God being a habitation for his people. Psalm 91, verse 1. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. But in this psalm, the experience is very different. Instead of this habitation being a place of critical scrutiny, this refuge, this habitation is a safe refuge for the psalmist. And this seems, as we mentioned earlier, to be the refrain of the psalm. Verse 2, I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him will I trust. And this repeated in verse, the idea is repeated in verse 9 and 10. Because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation, there shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. And the description of the place of this habitation is also significant. If we look at verse 4, he shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust. The verb cover here is the same used in Exodus 40 to describe the shielding of the ark by the veil in the tabernacle, and also to the covering of the ark by the wings of the cherubim. Maybe we could look back to Exodus 37 where we read this. Exodus 37, verse 9. And the cherubim spread out their wings on high, and covered with their wings over the mercy seat, with their faces one to another, even to the mercy seatward were the faces of the cherubims. So by describing the habitation in this way, the psalmist is saying that the believer is effectively being looked after in the presence of God, in the most holy place of the temple, above the mercy seat. Which is extraordinary when we think about it. We think how carefully the ordinary Israelites were kept away from even the holy place. And yet this psalmist seems to be saying that the faithful will dwell with God between the cherubim. And this is obviously prophetic, and it fits very well with the application of this psalm to Christ that we'll look at in a few minutes' time. With this in mind, it's little wonder then that the protection afforded by this refuge is so comprehensive. Verse 4 refers to a shield and a buckler. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. And this describes two kinds of protection. The shield was a large shield which used to cover the whole body, whereas the buckler was a smaller protector used to ward off specific attacks. So we can imagine that a soldier who is protected by both would be able to counter any attack directed at him, whether a large-scale attack which would require the shield or a more mobile attack requiring a buckler. And in fact, we read about various attacking forces which are described throughout the psalm. And this begins with the snare of the fowler in verse 3. And this is an image which occurs a number of times throughout the Old Testament. For example, in Psalm 124, it's used to describe God's deliverance of his people from the nations who had attacked them. In Ecclesiastes 9, it refers to the sons of men snared in an evil time, and they're compared with birds trapped in a snare. And in this context, there's an interesting link in Hosea 9, which maybe we could just look at briefly. Hosea 9 and verse 8, and I'll read that from the NIV. The prophet, along with my God, is the watchman over Ephraim, yet snares await him on all his paths and hostility in the house of his God. Now, as for the other attacks described as snares, this fits with the idea of an attack from an unexpected source or at an unexpected time, since if a prophet would expect to be safe anywhere, it would be in the temple, even if he felt unsafe elsewhere. The temple, at least, should have protected him, and yet this verse in Hosea describes him experiencing hostility in the house of his God. So this snare of the fowler in Psalm 90 would seem to represent tribulations brought on the believer by other people. It's a human agent. Attacks from human agencies are this snare of the fowler. In contrast, the noisome pestilence of the second part of the verse it probably just refers to disease, a sort of more natural disaster, if you can refer it to that way, just the normal consequences of the curse. And a similar two-part attack is described in verses 5 and 6, and it suggests that these verses are parallels of each other. A common thing in the Hebrew is that you have a parallelism, and it suggests that these verses show that. Verse 5 of Psalm 91 to verse 6, "Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday." So we have attacks by night and day described in both these verses. And the pestilence that walketh in darkness may be taken as an explanation of the otherwise undefined terror by night from verse 5. And similarly, the destruction that wasteth at noonday is parallel with the arrow that flieth by day. So here we have, again, a two-part attack, easily warded off by the shield and buckler defending the one in God's refuge, as depicted in the next two verses, with the believer being left standing, even though 1,000 fall at thy side. Verse 7, 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee. Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked. Now all these points suddenly come into sharper focus in the second part of the psalm, when we realise that these apply not just generally to the faithful, but specifically to Jesus. And the link here comes, as I'm sure we realised, in verses 11 and 12, which were selectively quoted by the adversary during Jesus' temptation. Let's, if you keep your finger in Psalm 91, but turn over to Matthew 4, verse 6, and we'll just compare the quotation there with the original passage in the psalm. Matthew 4, verse 6. The words of the tempter to Jesus. "If thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down." This is from the pinnacle of the temple. "For it is written, he shall give his angels charge concerning thee, and in their hands they shall bear thee up, lest at any time thou dash thy foot against a stone." Now if we look back to Psalm 91 and verses 11 and 12, which are quoted here, note that the tempter excludes the little phrase, "in all thy ways," from the latter part of verse 12. The original is, "he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways." And we can see how this might be excluded during the temptations of Jesus, because this little phrase, in all thy ways, tends to include the idea of God's care being active even during times of trouble or testing. Jesus' immediate experience may have been of trouble or immediate suffering, as it was after 40 days fasting in the wilderness. But ultimately, God was still protecting his son if he maintained his love for God and his focus on God's ultimate purpose for him. And in contrast, the temptations of Jesus were all about putting immediate gain before long-term benefit. The second part of this psalm, however, is all about the care of God for his son and his disciples. And we can see how images from this psalm are reflected in the New Testament. For example, if we look at verse 13, Psalm 91, thou shalt tread upon the lion and adder, the young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample under feet. And we now look to Luke chapter 10 and verse 18. We find very similar ideas used by Jesus when he received the 72 disciples back from their first preaching mission. Luke 10, verse 18. Verse 19. He said unto them, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Behold, I give unto you power to tread on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you. And the final oracle in the last three verses of Psalm 91 takes on a whole new level of significance when we apply it directly to Jesus. This was the man who was truly in the refuge of God. Alone of all mankind, he was worthy to enter the most holy place and dwell in the presence of God. And yet, not without trial. Look at verse 14 of Psalm 91. Because he hath set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him, implying that he was in need of deliverance. I will set him on high, because he hath known my name. And surely that phrase, I will set him on high, is a contrast to Jesus being lifted up in his death on the cross. And it refers to the glory that followed his humiliation in death. And again, we have a reference to knowing God's name. I will set him on high because he hath known my name. And this is, again, most appropriate to Jesus, who revealed God's name in its full meaning to his disciples. And the ultimate end of this faithful one is given in verse 16. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. And significantly, the salvation was to be shown directly to this man, not to the future generations, as in Psalm 90. So having looked at both psalms individually, albeit very briefly, again, I'd like to just finish by, again, a rather brief comparison and contrast of the two. And I think with what we've said earlier, the reason for doing this is that we can use Psalm 90 to describe those under the law of Moses, or more generally, those outside the protection of Jesus, whereas Psalm 91 describes the protection afforded by the saving work of Jesus. And the comparison of the two psalms, therefore, illuminates the difference between the two ministries and sort of reinforces how grateful we should be that we are under grace and not under law. And perhaps the most striking aspect is that both start from the same point. Both dispensations provide a habitation for God's people. However, for Moses, this proximity to God simply illuminated the people's failure and ultimately the failure of mankind to be able to serve God in the natural way of things. And I'll read you the very well-known words of Paul to the Romans, which sort of crystallize this idea. Romans 7, verse 9 to 10. For I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. and the commandment which was ordained to life I found to be unto death. And I think we see that in this psalm, don't we? The man described in this psalm was in the refuge of God, but the light of God's countenance just illuminated his shortcomings rather than pointing him to life. But the benefit of the law, correctly applied, was that it underlined the inability of man to save himself. It highlighted this to the believer and prompted them to look elsewhere for help. So in verse 12 of Psalm 90, "So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom." And this wisdom, if achieved, left room for hope, but in the future, as we've seen in verse 16, "Let thy work appear unto thy servants and thy glory unto their children." In contrast, the habitation described in Psalm 91 looks forward to the ultimate unity of God and his people. And I think possibly the words in Hebrews 6, 18 to 20 are the best summary of this. Hebrews 6, verse 18 to 20. "We might have a strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope set before us, which hope we have as an anchor for the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which entereth into that within the veil, whither the forerunner is for us entered, even Jesus, made an high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." As we've seen, the habitation described in Psalm 91 seems to be between the cherubim, within the veil, as described in Hebrews. And the result of this dwelling with God is completely different to that described under Moses. It leads to justification, not condemnation. Psalm 91, verse 10. "There shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways." Although the immediate experience of those under this dispensation may be difficult, it doesn't exclude the possibility of trial, as Jesus was the best example of that. Because we are under this law of grace, we can have confidence that we are not under God's wrath, as Israel were in the past, but we are in his good pleasure. We are not under the law that condemns, but under the law that justifies through the work of our Saviour Jesus, and that will, in the mercy of God, lead to the great reward offered to us all.